Looks like not. We're ready to proceed when you are.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Lance Cote. I'm with the firm Klein Cote & Edwards in Aspen. We represent the appellant in the first case that includes the MAA. Before I start, I'll revise the court. I discovered in our brief the case Casa Marie 752 F Sup 1152. We cited that case, and when I was getting ready, I discovered it had been reversed on other grounds than cited for in 988 F Second 252 for a second. So I want to apologize to the court for that. Okay. So if there's nobody wants to yell at me about that, I'll move forward.
Thank you.
Okay. This dispute arose when APTA instructed the landlord, my client, plaintiff in this case, that they could not rent to qualified employees during the summer, that they had to rent to non-qualified employees, or non-qualified music students or music faculty. That led to all these claims being filed and cross claims was the dispute over that issue. In this case, even though the trial court ruled against my client, the judge did find that the ordinance at issue, the resolution at issue in that case, actually violated the rent control statute. And I think it's important then to focus on the reasons why, even though the resolution in question did violate the rent control statute, why she still ruled against us. And I think that the main reason was that the trial judge failed to take into consideration the state concern issues that the Supreme Court in Telluride had found so important in its analysis. And if the idea from Telluride was that the reason there was a statewide concern and why this issue was a matter of state policy versus local municipalities regulating rent control was to avoid a patchwork of problems preserving investment capital in the rental market, ensuring stable quantity and quality of housing, maintaining tax revenues generated by rental properties, and protecting the state's overall economic health. In this case, the trial court seemed to focus on the issue of what was the landlord's legitimate expectation or concerns if she were to avoid something that she recognized that the county should not have done. And I think that if we focus instead on what the issue is to this one individual and focus instead on the state's interest in preserving all these things that were identified in Telluride, that the result should be reversed.
Mr. Cote, if I can back you up for a minute. I know both parties have submitted supplemental briefs in this case, assume for a moment that we'll grant those motions. I can't speak for my colleagues, but assuming that we would hear this argument on retroactivity, would you mind addressing that? I think that's probably a preliminary issue we should take up because that may focus the analysis differently.
Absolutely. In our view, it almost doesn't matter, believe it or not, if this amendment is applied retroactively in our case. The issue of voluntariness in the current case, the MAA case, if I can call it that, is one where, voluntariness is the key difference, I would say, that I think the parties have identified on voluntariness is now expressly in the statute, in the amended statute, as being an issue. The voluntariness is, though, limited by, I think, subsection 4 of the amended statute, which says that notwithstanding any other provision of this section, a county or municipality may not deny an application for a development permit because an applicant for such a permit declines to enter into such an or into an agreement to limit rent on either a private residential property or a private residential housing unit. So that there has to be the possibility, applied retroactively, that the developer, in this case, or now the person, the plaintiff, could have said no and still gotten his development approval. That did not exist.
How do we know that, again, assuming, and it's an issue, of course, not only retroactive, whether it's retrospective, assuming for a moment that we would say it's not retrospective and we would apply this statute, no one addressed this question, it seems to me, in this case of voluntariness. I know the court in the other case, and you guys got a half hour to talk about that one later, if we were to go this way, could we rule as a matter of law on this issue?
Well, I believe you can. Let me give you my pitch on that. Is in the trial court's order in paragraph 85, she does say that there was that she made a finding that was a voluntariness in this case. Now, but then in paragraph 86, she sort of goes on to explain why she thought it was voluntary. And she identifies that the developer had a choice of the type that the Telluride statute provided. Well, you could write us a check, or you could do something different, right? Now, the court in Telluride has already said that's not a good enough choice to have. And she had the VOCC resolution in front of her, which said, and which she acknowledged said, you shall take this step, you shall impose a deed restriction that limits rents.
So, do you know, Mr. Cote, whether in the ordinance at issue in Telluride, and I know your colleagues, I think, were involved in that case. Maybe you were too.
Was
there a sense? Telluride talks about this point system, or unless I may have this backwards. This case, I think, had a point system.
Yes.
It was the same system in effect in Telluride. Is there a difference between the voluntariness and mandatoriness between the two cases?
I'd say that in the Telluride case, they identified different choices, like a cash in lieu was identified in our case and in Telluride. And so to that extent, yes, they were the same. Is that the idea, regardless of the details of, let's say, the statutory construct, that what they said was that if this is part of a scheme of rent control, it's a scheme for rent control, it doesn't work. You can't do it because you're interfering with these state concerns. So, if the details aren't exactly the same in each statute, I would say that the policy announced by the Telluride Court would govern, so long as you have one of the burdens being placed on the developer is the prospect of rent-controlled rental units, then this is not okay. This is a matter of statewide concern, and that the legislature will deal with that on a statewide basis.
Mr. Cote, if I could shift the argument just a little bit. I mean, one of the issues that's addressed at length in the briefs is the timeliness of the proceeding and whether or not this should have been filed earlier by Mr. Meyerstein's predecessor in interest. Can you tell us what your thoughts are about that?
On the 106 issue.
Yes.
Right. We aren't alleging an abuse of discretion or an arbitrary act by the government entity here. What we're doing is saying that this violates the law. It is more in the context of a Rule 57 argument.
Well, let me just clarify, if I might interrupt you. I didn't get the sense from the trial court's decision in this case, which is at odds perhaps with the decision in the other case, that you were challenging the validity of the Aspen ordinances on their face, but rather their application in this particular situation. Am I correct in that regard?
What we were challenging was the resolution. Remember, the statute still says the resolution that would limit rents. So there's a resolution in this case, and then a deed restriction issued pursuant to that resolution. So our complaint was not seeking to attack directly the statute, but the resolution that would be prohibited by the statute. That was the BOCC resolution that was identified in the trial court's order.
Right, but in doing that, then aren't you still challenging, that's a resolution that applied specifically to this property. So aren't you making a specific challenge to the that applies only in this situation as opposed to all housing projects in Aspen?
It's totally fair, and yes, we are challenging this resolution, which applies to this project under the statute. What we're saying is not that there was some abuse of discretion in enacting the thing itself. We're not challenging the PUD decision. What we're saying is that you can't use a resolution and then a deed restriction to violate this important state policy, the statute, to accomplish rent control goals. Even if there was a 106 requirement here, you know, as the trial judge put out in the other case, is that the remedy is not sufficient, because what we have is really what we're attacking is the legislation itself, because it really, that legislation, if you're going to call the resolution legislation, applies just to us. So we want to attack that under Rule 57, and not so much because of any abuse of discretion, just because this is not legal. You can't just do this. It's in the sort of an ultra virus argument, is that this is beyond the scope of what you're allowed to do. And so we should be able to come in at any time, like in the Shelley case, the racial restriction, de-restriction case, the U.S. Supreme Court, where they came in much later and they said, well, this is an ongoing thing. You can raise this at any time. It's not that somebody did something, somebody abused their discretion. And it's also not proper to be giving, apply the 106 standard to the landlord in this case, where what you have is just a legislation that is completely not allowed. When the town violates the statute, and in this case, Teddy was decided before the deed restriction was entered, to give them deference is completely improper.
But it seems to me that when the deed restrictions and the PUD were approved, that the parties involved had an interest in finality and knowing that decision could be relied on unless it was challenged promptly. And certainly, what you're suggesting seems like there's no time limit at all that should apply.
Well, I would suggest that any municipality that violates the rent control statute should be on notice that there is no time limit, that you cannot ignore the public policy of the state of Colorado, even if you're a city, and expect to get away with it forever, would be my response to a town that was complaining about, we were interested in finality. Can I save my last 90 seconds?
Of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Tom Smith. Registration number 6463 with the firm of Austin Pearson Smith in Aspen. I'm here on behalf of the Aspen Pitkin County Housing Authority. I believe you have a filing from John Worcester, City Attorney of Aspen, that they're not going to appear, but that their position is the same as ours. In using my time here, I am not going to address the Rule 106 issues that are directly associated with the Housing Authority's enforcement action involving the MAA covenant, as it's called in the briefs. Mr. Thomas, who is here for the Music Associates, will address that. I also don't intend to address the statute of limitations issues that relate to the Section 1983 and regulatory takings claims that are present in this case, unless the court has questions about those, but I think the briefs address those adequately. I do want to get to the voluntariness issue that you, Judge Gabriel, have asked about, but I also would like to spend a little time with the jurisdictional issue that Judge Taubman has raised relative to Rule 106. I think it's very important to analyze what exactly it is that Mr. Meyerstein is challenging in this case. He calls it a challenge to the deed restriction, but a challenge to the deed restriction as the quote-unquote product of an illegal county resolution. Well, the so-called illegal county resolution is the county's decision in 1998 to approve this project, the Aspen Highlands Village PUD, with conditions. And it's our view that only the developer had the opportunity to challenge that resolution and the conditions in that resolution, including those related to the affordable housing requirements.
Mr. Smith, if yes. I may interrupt, what is your response, though, to Mr. Cote's analogy to the Shelley v. Kramer case involving discrimination, that if there's something illegal about the ordinance, shouldn't Mr. Meyerstein be able to challenge it?
My answer to that is no, that this case does not involve invidious discrimination or suspect classifications. It involves economic regulation, and the court must inquire behind the claim that public policy is violated here, because it is not correct that on its face the deed restriction is facially invalid. The court must conduct an inquiry. The inquiry includes analyzing the statute, including the amendments to the rent control statute embodied in House Bill 1017 from last year. There's another exception in the statute that predates that amendment on the question of whether or not the property interest held by the housing authority through the deed restriction also creates an exception to the statute. So we are not dealing with a situation at all like a case of invidious discrimination with respect to a suspect classification.
Let's take a different example, Mr. Smith. Let's take a racial covenant. Say instead of rent control in this case, or alleged rent control provision, the original PUD say you cannot rent to an African American. Right. Then 20 years go by, and Mr. Meyerstein buys the property, and he says, that's outrageous, and he files an action against it. I suppose you could still make the argument you're making here that that was up to the developer to challenge that in a 106 proceeding. And I guess my question to you is, why is that the case?
Well, I guess, Judge, I would say that that could be challenged and that it's distinct from this case because it does involve invidious discrimination and suspect classification with grave constitutional issues implicated. And there, that presents, I think, a factually and legally very distinct case from the present one. This case is more like the Lone Pine case decided by this court in 1982, Lone Pine versus City of Fort Lupton. In that case, a property owner challenged conditions in a development approval that required a payment of an impact fee for school dedication impact fee. The basis for the challenge was that the condition was ultra-vires. This court found that where the developer had accepted the conditions of approval, relied on the approval, and acted upon it to its benefit, and induced the local government to approve the project with the representation that those conditions would be satisfied, there was a waiver and estoppel to preclude the developer from challenging those conditions.
But correct me if that's wrong, in that case, wasn't it the developer, him or her, or itself, bringing the challenge? The developer who was part of the original proceeding was the one then wanted to challenge it. Am I right about that?
I believe so.
Right. Isn't that distinct here? Meyerstein, and I don't think the parties dispute, but correct me, had no notice of the original proceeding. He was, I think, in California. Not even here, did not participate in the original proceeding. And so doesn't that make this case distinguishable? It's not a rhetorical question. I'd like your answer. Isn't that make this case distinguishable from Lone Pine?
No, for two reasons. One, the deed restriction is a recorded document. That deed restriction was a matter of record when Mr. Meyerstein purchased the property. He was on notice of the requirement that had been adopted pursuant to the development approvals. He was not obligated to buy the property.
But your argument is that he had 30 days from the date the original PUD was approved.
No, I'm not arguing that he had 30 days, but I'm arguing that the unappealed decision of the county to approve the project with conditions has res judicata and collateral estoppel effect in subsequent proceedings.
But doesn't he have to be a party for res judicata and collateral estoppel to apply, or at least someone in privity with him?
Not according to University of Tennessee versus Elliott, Judge. U.S. Supreme Court case. Now, related to that is the fact that a purchaser of property takes property subject to the recorded restrictions that are a matter of record. The deed restriction in this case, which has to be invalidated for Meyerstein to get what he wants. Okay? It's no question that in order for him to gain anything, that document has to be declared invalid. The rent control statute does not preclude servitudes. It precludes ordinances and resolutions, and what we are saying is that the resolution is that was approved by the county, which included the condition, is entitled to res judicata and collateral estoppel effect in this proceeding. Now, with respect, let's turn to if we get past all of this and we get to the rent control statute and the voluntariness question. The appellant in this case has not focused the court on any of the criteria by which the courts decide an issue of voluntariness. On one hand, there are situations where the court will say an agreement is involuntary and unenforceable where there is fraud, duress, or incapacity. And on the other hand, in order to determine if an agreement is valid, the courts look to whether or not there are objective manifestations of mutual assent. These are the ways in which the court talks about this issue. In this case, there is no allegation of fraud, duress, or incapacity. What there is a general statement that the conditions of approval were forced on the developer. Well, you know, anything that the developer has to do can be viewed that way. Paying an application fee is not something that a developer would want to do if he didn't have to. But he does it. He does it in order to get the application considered and in order to get it approved.
But if you had a statewide statute that said there could be no application fee, then that would be in violation of the statute, and wouldn't, and under Telluride, wouldn't we say it really was involuntary, that to the extent he agreed with it, it was because your local statute said you're not going to get your permit.
Correct.
Well, why doesn't that apply here in terms of voluntariness?
Because the prohibition contained in the rent control statute is not absolute. It contains exceptions. And one of the exceptions is for a voluntary agreement to abide by rent control restrictions. In this case, the application included a proposal for this rental housing. The developer accepted the approval and acted on it and didn't challenge it within the 30 days of Rule 106. He built the project. In fact, this very housing that is the subject of this case was built by the developer to house the employees. And the deed restriction was adopted by the developer. He could have challenged the condition under Rule 106, but didn't do so. All of these things indicate to us objective manifestation of mutual consent, which is the legal criterion for determining if an agreement is enforceable as a voluntary agreement.
I ask you a question here, Mr. Smith, and yes. You've got 5 minutes, and I know you're sharing time. You don't get any extra time, so I just wanted to warn you of that. In terms of this, I understood what you just argued. I don't believe this issue was presented to the district court this way. So if we were to get this far, so hypothetically, if we were to disagree, and I'm not suggesting we are, with everything you've said, and we're now up to the question of, okay, the new statute applies, why wouldn't we have to send it back to the district court to decide in the first instance the question of voluntariness?
Because we believe that the record contains objective manifestations of mutual consent by the developer in this case to abide by the conditions of approval, and that Mr. Meyerstein's subjective opinion that the developer didn't agree doesn't get us anywhere.
But doesn't he get a chance to put on that evidence in for purposes of summary judgment? That hasn't been decided yet.
I would say no, because of the fact that the record of the way this case was presented, the application, the approvals, the deed restriction, the development of the project, are enough for the court to decide as a matter of law that the developer voluntarily agreed. Now, what is the best that they're going to get out of a developer in a deposition or a trial? I didn't want to do it, but I had to do it to get the approval. Okay? Did you accept the approval? Yes. Did you build the affordable housing? Yes. Did you adopt the deed restriction? Yes. Did you induce the government to approve the project with a representation that you would do this? Yes. To us, that's voluntary. Okay? I will leave the rest of my time to Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Peter Thomas, registration 27657, appearing on behalf of Music Associates of Aspen. I'm going to briefly address the question of the language and interpretation of the deed restriction, which the appellant argues that notwithstanding all these other issues, that the deed does not in any event require them to make these units available for MAA to rent. The appellant's focus on the permissive nature of the word may misses the point, though. There's no debate that one party or the other has the right to occupy these units in the summer season. The simple question is, who? Whose choice is it as to who's going to occupy those units? That answer can be found just by looking at the plain language of the deed restriction. The deed restriction, or the appellant actually relies on a single sentence to suggest that it has the right to select a qualified tenant of his or her choice. And therefore, the permissive nature runs to Meyerstein to select who that tenant's going to be. But in making that argument, the trust takes that sentence completely out of context and fails to read it in harmony with the entire paragraph, specifically the sentence before it and the sentence right after it, that talk about the winter seasonal use being subject to only being available for tenants who qualify under the APCHA guidelines, and that the owner has the right to select a qualified tenant pursuant to those APCHA guidelines. But the summer occupancy that my client has the right to, summer occupancy does not have to be approved by APCHA. It's impossible to reconcile that language with the trust argument. They basically create an ambiguity where none exists. But even if we said that an ambiguity does exist, if we look at the body of evidence, it's overwhelming. It's compelling. In fact, it can't even be disputed that the PUD guide, the resolution itself that's being challenged, all clearly state that preferred use of these units was always to be available for Music Associates of Aspen. So in other words, it's not a right that Meyerstein at its election may take away from MAA. It's a right that MAA at its election may opt to exercise. I'll briefly address the question of special legislation.
Your time's up, I'm afraid, Mr. Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Briefly, I want to direct the court's attention to the case, let's see, where did it go? Yee v. Escondido, 503 U.S. 519, a 1992 rent control case about mobile homes in San Diego. There, the court, I think it was Justice Kennedy, wrote for the majority, said that if you were requiring a landowner to rent to someone, that would constitute a taking. It would be a physical intrusion into the property, right? It would be a physical taking, not just a regulatory taking. And I think that's what we have here. Involuntariness, addressing Mr. Smith's point, he's trying to direct the court to sort of a contract analysis between willing buyer, willing seller, you know, the people that meet in the marketplace and can make a decision like this. Whereas here, that's the wrong test to apply. The right test to apply is one, was there a meaningful choice? And when Telluride has already said that is not a meaningful choice, we don't need to be doing this voluntariness analysis using these contract principles. Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perry. Okay. We thank all counsel for your arguments and your briefs in this case. This one will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. I guess now we can reconstitute, and I guess, Mr. Thomas, you're going to get traded out for counsel for Starwood. Thank you very much.
Aye.